Thank you very much, Ken. Lunch and learn is a good name for this event. I learned quite a bit when I was researching the story of Bernard Manning, and I'm going to pass along a little bit today of what I learned during the time that I was rehearsing his story. Specifically, I want to talk to you about other people's money. I'd like to tell you why the social credit government decided in the 1930s that it should use other people's money to develop the province's oil and gas resources. Now, you may remember a movie that came out in the early 1990s. It was called Other People's Money. It had Danny DeVito playing a character called Larry the Liquidator. And in his very first speech in the movie, Danny looks directly into the camera and he says, "I love money. I love money more than the things that it can buy. There's only one thing I love more than money. You know what that is? It's other people's money." Well, the social credit government of the 1930s loved other people's money too. And it had to love other people's money because it didn't have any money of its own. It first got elected in August 1935 with a promise that it was going to pay every citizen of Alberta a dividend of $25 a month. Now, the former government, the United Farmers, they had been collecting taxes every year that added up to a total of $20 million. This proposed dividend scheme by the social creditors was going to cost $360 million, 18 times as much. Where was the money going to come from? The voters didn't care. They believed in the dream. They had nothing to lose, really. So they elected social credit in a landslide. And wouldn't you know it, they lined up outside Calgary City Hall the next day to collect their dividends. Well, needless to say, there were no dividends. There were no dividends in 1935. There were no dividends in 1936. There were no dividends, in fact, in any year until sometime in the 1950s. Because the government was broke. The cupboard was bare. So what did the government do? It resorted to desperation measures. It brought in new legislation to put a tax on the banks, or at least to try to. But the federal government shot down that legislation. The Fed said that Ottawa, not the provinces, was in charge of Canada's banking system. Then the social credit government brought in a law that would cut in half the interest payable on loans and mortgages. That didn't fly either. Once again, the proposed legislation was disallowed by the federal government. Then, in 1936, there was a big discovery of oil in Turner Valley. The well was drilled by a company called Turner Valley Royalties, which was run by a hard-drinking wildcatter named Robert Streetcar Brown. He got his nickname Streetcar because he ran the city of Calgary's municipal railway system on the side. He had a philosophy that he passed on to his son Bobby. He said, "I have an effective arrangement with my managers," Streetcar said. "I find the money, they find the oil, other people's money." So in 1938, the social credit government decided to get involved in the business of oil and gas, because every piece of economic reform legislation that it had brought in to stimulate the finances of the province had been blocked by the feds or by the courts, so it had to find another way. And one of the obvious potentials was in the area of petroleum development. If oil could be found in sufficiently large quantities, that would change the whole economy of Alberta. So, the social credit government went looking for other people's money. First, it tried to convince the investment houses in eastern Canada that they should take a hard look at the potential of oil and gas. But the eastern investors were not interested. Too risky, they said. They only wanted to put their money into gold and copper mines. Then the Alberta delegation went over to England to see if there was any possibility that the people there might want to put their money into oil development. The English were interested, but they did not want to invest in Canada while England was facing the threat of a world war. As Ernest Manning said afterwards, they just wanted to sit on the sidelines for a while to see what was going to happen. The next on the list were the Americans, and they were very interested. As Manning said, the American response was very good, very positive. But the Americans have to understand one thing. They would not be assuming an ownership stake in any of the Alberta properties where they went drilling for oil. We were completely committed to the development of those resources by private enterprise, Manning said, but only under lease agreements. We were never going to give up title of ownership to any of our mineral resources. The fact that the development was being done by American companies was immaterial, said Manning. They were operating under terms that the government of the province had laid down. Now, at the same time that I was trying to persuade outsiders to invest in Alberta oil development, the Social Credit government was bringing in legislation to regulate this industry that it was hoping was going to grow and prosper in the future. Now, this again was back in 1938, before we had much of an industry to speak of. The first piece of legislation made possible the creation of the Petroleum and Natural Gas Conservation Board, which nowadays we call the Energy Resources Conservation Board, the ERCB, to set production quotas from oil wells and to prevent the oil companies, particularly those drilling in Turner Valley, from wasting natural gas by flaring. Now, natural gas, as you know, had limited commercial potential in those days, so the oil producers got rid of the unwanted gas by burning it. And you've heard this story before. The amount of gas burned was so extensive that the red sky from Turner Valley could be seen as far away as Calgary. And some Calgarians used to talk about sitting outside on summer nights and reading by the light of the flares from Turner Valley. And this was a problem that the Alberta government had been trying to control for years. The mines minister, Charles Ross, said in 1936 that over the previous 24 years, well, really since 1914, the oil companies had wasted more than $104 million worth of gas, they'd wasted that, while taking out just $23 million worth of oil. The producers, of course, did not like this new anti-wasting legislation because it forced them to cap wells before they had taken out all the available oil, but it did establish a system of conserving gas reserves that would prove beneficial to Alberta in the future. Now, in the early 1940s, Turner Valley started to fizzle out. Bobby Brown, the wildcatting son of Streetcar Brown, he quit the oil business and started to sell home appliances for a living. Then, of course, came Leduc. Imperial Oil's number one discovery well blew in, and a big shower of oil rained down on the dancing drillers. This was the gusher that was going to boost the value of Alberta's gross domestic product to $30 billion over the next 20 years. This was the gusher that was going to help make the proceeds from oil and gas account for almost 40% of all provincial revenues. But this major economic transformation did not happen all at once. In 1953, after there had been major oil strikes in Redwater, Golden Spike, Fan Big Valley, Wizard Lake, Bonnie Glen, and Pembina, as well as Leduc, of course, Manning surprised an audience in London, England, by saying that agriculture was still the Alberta government's main source of revenue. Now, this was 6 years after Leduc. Now, he pointed out that more than half of Alberta's 1 million residents still lived in the rural area, and that the annual return of $218 million from agriculture was more than three times the amount being collected from all of the province's mineral resources, including coal, as well as oil and gas. Manning said that while the development of oil had caught the imaginations of people and attracted the spotlight of the world, agriculture still remains our predominant industry. Now, the reason, of course, was obvious. Oil and gas resources took time to be developed. A big oil strike always had a certain glamour to it. Every time a new field was discovered, the news would be blazed across Canada. Images would abound of money just pouring into the provincial coffers. The Prime Minister, Mackenzie King, would declare that Alberta was making steady progress towards a place of eminence in our national economy. But Manning said that these images were very badly distorted. The development wells still had to be built, and the wells had to start producing. Now, that process could take up to a year or more for each well, and during that time, there would be no royalty revenue coming in. And yet, while it was now clear to everyone that Alberta's future prosperity would not be built on sales of wheat and barley, the transformation to an energy-based economy was not going to happen overnight. The discoveries at Leduc and Redwater and elsewhere, they left the Manning administration with two choices to be made in terms of future development. The first was to let the American companies continue to take the risks and also to reap the potential rewards under the ground rules that had been set down by the province. The second was to go the Saskatchewan CCF route and develop an Alberta-based industry using either a government-owned oil company or a government-controlled public-private partnership. But Manning, as a free market fundamentalist, was ideologically opposed to governments getting involved in the oil business, because oil exploration was notoriously risky, complicated, expensive. It required expertise and financial resources that the Alberta government simply didn't have. Manning's cabinet colleague, Hal Pook, pointed out that the American oil companies had spent up to $20 million drilling dry holes in Alberta before Imperial struck oil at Leduc. How could any government get away with doing that? Asked Hook. How would any government stay in office if it was gambling away $20 million of the people's money on dry holes? So, for Manning and his administration, the most sensible solution, obviously, was to let the Americans keep taking the risk. Now, I suppose it was perhaps inevitable that at some point the people who were critical of the Manning administration were going to come along and say that maybe it's not such a great idea to have the Americans coming in and running our oil industry for us. And sure enough, a political science prof at the University of Alberta named Larry Pratt and a former Saskatchewan MLA named John Richards, they co-wrote a book called Prairie Capitalism, in which they accused the Manning administration of selling out to the Americans and allowing them to call the shots and dictate government policy. The government lost and the Americans won, said Pratt and Richards. The Americans now control the industry. And similarly critical was James H. Gray, the great prairie social historian, who wrote such best-selling books as Red Lights on the Prairies and Booze, and was also actually a longtime member of the Petroleum Club here. In 1955, Gray became the editor of the Western Oil Examiner. He was hired by Bobby Brown to write about the small number of independent Canadian companies that were battling for survival in the oil patch. And Bobby Brown, by that point, was back in the business again. He was now running Federated Petroleums and Home Oil. Now, trying to give support to the tiny number of Canadians operating in the oil patch, it really put James Gray between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, he was writing these editorials criticizing the Americans for controlling the industry. On the other hand, he was almost totally dependent on the Americans for the advertising that appeared in the magazine. So, as I write in my book, How the West Was Written, for the book, he felt like, and I love this quote, he said, he felt like a silver-tongued orator at a deaf-mute convention. Because without the advertising, the American advertising, the Western Oil Examiner was as good as dead. And sure enough, the magazine folded in 1958, just 3 years after Gray took over as the editor. Now, Ernest Manning, as you might expect, vehemently disagreed with the argument that the Americans were controlling the industry. It's all nonsense, he said. The assessment of this whole thing is the typical assessment of the committed socialists with that cynical, supercilious, patronizing attitude towards private enterprise and the free economy. By the way, Manning wasn't talking about James Gray here, although Gray did have some socialist credentials because he'd been a former member of the Independent Labour Party of Manitoba. Now, Manning was talking about the other critics from the left, that's John Richards and Larry Pratt. And Manning said, look at it this way. The province owns the mineral rights to more than 85% of the land in Alberta. Control over the access to the oil and the conditions of its production have always remained in government hands. And he said, if I understand anything at all about ownership and control, is that when you own something, you control the terms under which it's going to be used. And I don't think you can say that the person developing the resource is in control of it. And but then Richards and Pratt would come back and say, yeah, but didn't the Manning administration simply develop these lease agreements in consultation with the industry? Didn't the government just go along with what the Americans wanted and create policies that were based on those already existing in places such as Texas and California and Oklahoma? No, said Manning. The government was always in the driver's seat. The oil companies had no option but to accept the government's terms. This was not a nice, cozy arrangement where we went along with everything they said. There was consultation, yes, but with the ultimate decision being made by the government. Now, when Manning said there was no nice, cozy arrangement between his government and the oil companies, he left out one thing. He didn't mention the fact that when it came to looking at the possible commercial development of the oil sands, which was also to be done with other people's money, there was what you could only call a nice, cozy arrangement between Manning and a prominent American oil executive named John Howard Pugh. And this arrangement had as much to do with their shared interest in evangelical Christianity as it had to do with their interest in exploring the potential of the oil sands. And they met when Manning was reaching out to American evangelicals to provide support for his radio ministry, which was a nationally syndicated program called Back to the Bible. Now, I should stop here for a moment to tell you a little bit about Back to the Bible. It was a very popular radio program. It attracted bigger audiences than Jack Benny. Manning was involved with it for several years before he went into provincial politics, all during his years in politics, and he carried on as director of the program for many years after he left politics. At one point, it was heard on more than 100 radio stations across Canada, and woe betide any radio programmer who ever dared cut into the show with the hockey scores or the election results. Let me tell you a story about that. This happened in Prince George on a March evening in 1971. I was working in radio then. I was doing my regular nightly news shift at CJCI Radio, pulling stories off the wire, preparing them for broadcast. And the usual stories, a state of emergency had been declared in Quebec because of a snowstorm. Dave Barrett, the leader of British Columbia's New Democratic Party, had been kicked out of the legislature for refusing to take his seat during a budget debate, that sort of thing. Then the bulletin alarm bell sounded on the broadcast news wire machine. The news gave me a shiver of excitement. Canada's 51-year-old Prime Minister, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, had secretly married the 22-year-old daughter of a former federal cabinet minister. I ripped the Trudeau story from the wire machine, sprinted into the news studio, asked the DJ to interrupt the Thursday night program of Back to the Bible, and I read out the short announcement.
Good evening. This is a news bulletin from CJCI Radio. Prime Minister Trudeau is married in North Vancouver tonight. More details coming up on the news at 10 o'clock.
My phone was ringing off the hook when I got back to the newsroom. I had committed a no-no, it seems. The first five callers were outraged that I had cut into the Back to the Bible program. They didn't want to hear anything about Trudeau. They wanted to hear Ernest Manning preach. But the sixth caller was different. He was in a jubilant mood. I'm ready to celebrate, he said. Did you say that Trudeau was murdered tonight? So, Ernest Manning was the director of the Back to the Bible program, and John Howard Pugh was a big supporter of the radio ministry. And Pugh, of course, was the chairman of Sun Oil of Philadelphia. And this was interesting, I thought. For more than 10 years, he funneled money into the Back to the Bible program to keep it on the air. So obviously there was a close relationship between Mr. Manning and Mr. Pugh. And Pugh had also been one of the first people to take a serious look at the potential of the oil sands Because as far back as 1904, when he was a young research scientist at Sun Oil, Pew thought that the oil from the sands might be turned into asphalt for road paving, but that turned out to be uneconomical. And Pew eventually considered that the oil sands had more potential as a source of synthetic crude for use as feedstock in Sun's oil refineries. So we jump forward to 1950, when the Alberta government issues a report saying that the oil sands are entering the stage of possible commercial development. And who gets the first contract to build a commercial separation plant for the oil sands? A company called Great Canadian Oil Sands, which just happens to be financed by Sun Oil and by J. Howard Pugh. Why did Pugh get the contract? Now, while it might be tempting to believe it had something to do with Pugh's close relationship with Manning, and I should tell you here that the two men and their wives used to go on camping holidays together in Jasper National Park, I'm more inclined to take the charitable view and believe that the contract was given to Great Canadian because its plant was going to be a much smaller operation than the plants proposed by the main competitors, Imperial Oil and Shell. And while on the one hand both Manning and Pugh agree that the discovery of a huge conventional oil source at Leduc was not a reason to delay the possible commercial development of the oil sands, at the same time they also agreed, and certainly the Alberta Oil and Gas Conservation Board agreed, that the activity in the oil sands should not pose a threat to the conventional oil producers. The market for conventional oil then could be quite volatile, so the board wanted the output from the oil sands to be as small as possible. So that gives you a sense of the nice, cozy arrangement that existed between Manning and J. Howard Pugh, this American oil executive who put the financing together for what was then seen as the biggest gamble in oil patch history. And I should hasten to add that I'm not suggesting there was any conflict of interest here. Because for one thing, Manning never personally took 1 cent from the money collected for his radio ministry. He did it entirely on a volunteer basis for more than 50 years. But you know, I think if the same issue were to surface today, people would question the propriety of a sitting premier allowing money to flow into his radio show from someone with a big stake in the oil sands development. So then you have to ask, well, why didn't the opposition call him on this? Why didn't they holler? Why was there no criticism? Well, the matter plainly and simply was because it never came out. This information didn't actually become public until about 8 years after Manning had left provincial politics in the mid-1970s. And how it came about was the Toronto Star was doing... We're doing a story on a high-end Christian retreat center called the Canadian Keswick Conference in Ontario, which had a mysterious fire there and then went bankrupt. And they discovered in the first instance that that Ernest Manning had been a director of the Keswick Conference, had been a director of this Christian retreat center. And they also discovered that money had been coming from the J. Howard Pugh charitable trust that was funneled anonymously through the Keswick Conference and went from there into the Back to the Bible radio program. And so when the Toronto Star reporter came across this, he phoned up Mr. Manning and he said, well, wasn't that a conflict of interest? And Manning said, oh no, absolutely not. And that was it. That was the end of the story. There was no follow-up question. No, and the thing was, when I was writing it, I was thinking, damn, you should have asked one more question. Anyway, what can you do? And as I said, by then, Manning, of course, was out of provincial politics, so it wasn't an issue that the opposition would have raised anyway. Now, Manning did say, after he left politics, that he would have preferred to have seen Canadian rather than American money being used to develop Alberta's oil and gas resources. But, as I said earlier, the Canadian investment houses had never shown any interest in diverting risk capital to Western Canada, and the British industrialists basically missed out on the opportunity because they sat on the sidelines. So that just left the Americans. And Manning was very happy, of course, to see the Americans coming in. And that leaves us with the big question. Did Albertans win or lose because of Manning's decision to let the American companies develop the oil and gas resources in Alberta. Now, the critics say we could have done better. Richards and Pratt have said that while the province did reap huge revenues from the oil exploration and development, it also allowed a handful of big foreign players to dominate in the oil patch, and that these players pursued development at a pace that eventually left Alberta with an excessive accumulation of oil and gas reserves, and left the developers with an excessive accumulation of profits. Now, Manning, of course, dismissed this argument as the run-of-the-mill socialist position held by the economic naturalists, who believe that the foreign companies were always the bad guys, and that anybody who dealt with them had to be suspect. This is the fundamental position of the person who is anti-private enterprise, Manning said. This is the person who thinks that the ideal way for all of this development to have taken place was for the province to have done it by itself. So, how did the people of Alberta feel about all this? Well, I don't think you would have heard too many complaints during the years between 1948 and 1967, because the voters kept re-electing Manning with sizable majorities. Very few people felt shortchanged by his government's decision to let the Americans continue developing the resource. We were the only province in Canada without a sales tax. We had paved highways, lots of them, modern hospitals, good public schools, plenty of senior citizens' lodges, plenty of public recreational facilities, and we had money in the bank. So, what would the alternative have been if, instead of using other people's money, American money, we had clung to our economic sovereignty and borrowed whatever money it would have taken to make Alberta the master of its own universe? Well, there's a widely quoted, circulated quote from the 1970s, which doesn't really apply anymore because circumstances have changed. But it used to be trotted out whenever the free enterprisers wanted to put the economic nationalists in their place. Look at Saskatchewan, the argument went. She did stick up for her economic sovereignty, and where did that get her? Her major export is people. Thank you very much.
They used to say that about Ireland, too.
I still do. Now that the Celtic Tiger has gone down in flames.
Okay, are there any questions from the audience?
When GCRS and Frank Paul Schumpeter in 67, the price of oil was less than $3. Would you like to do that today?
No. They don't know.
And Mr. Pugh, therefore, carried the thing. It wasn't just Frank Paul that carried it. Mr. Pugh carried it.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, he put up his own personal stake was more than the money that that Sun Oil.
Apparently, Pugh spoke to his board, and he said, gentlemen and others, you're going to approve this project, or I'm going to do it myself.
Yes, yeah.
At that time, he was the 7th richest man in the United States with some $8 billion in his pocket.
Right, yeah.
U.S. dollars, I mean, $8 billion way back then.
Right,
but
yeah.
But the strange thing is that the Glenbeigh Trust, which is the Pew Foundation, supports Greenpeace.
Oh, is that right? Interesting.
They're one of the main supporters of Greenpeace.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you imagine? Greenpeace and Sun Oil.
The oil sands and all that. Yeah. Interesting synergy there, all right. Yeah, sure.
Going back to 1904, was that from
the
Sands in the
U.S.? No, it was in Athabasca. He'd actually been up there. He went up as a young geologist and did some work up there. And was, in fact, they did pave some roads for a while, as I recall. But then they discovered that these were the most expensive roads in the Western Hemisphere. So they didn't keep up with it. They realized that using the oil from
Minister Maynard rode from his place just outside of Edmonton, got the first pavement of the sand.
Oh, is that right?
That's first paved road there.
Yeah.
There's a sidewalk in Camrose, I think you can still find, and used to be the access road to the Jasper Park Lodge.
Yeah. So he had he'd been looking at it for the longest time, and then I guess eventually they had these refining operations all over the world, and realized that if we're going to provide the feedstock, that maybe we have to start looking at the oil sands. And I mean, Manning at the time is, you know, on the one hand, he said, well, you know, we have Leduc. I mean, we have all this conventional oil happening in the province. Why would we bother with the oil sands at all? And I guess Manning's feeling was, well, why not? It's there. Why not? Why shouldn't we at least take a look and see if it might be possible to do some commercial exploitation in there? And then, sure enough, it was it Sidney Blair was the one who produced the report in 1950 that said that, hey, we're just on the cusp of commercial exploitation here. So, but they didn't want to sort of jump into it in at the deep end. They just wanted to do it very, very slowly, and that's why it was a great Canadian that got involved.
Can I tell you another anecdote?
Sure, yeah.
GQ was planning an approval to build this thing,
yeah,
because they were going to use 31,000 barrels a day.
Right, yeah.
Syncrude wanted 100,000, and the government didn't want that much oil coming just from the one place.
Sure.
And Charlie Dunkley, who was with Dome, came to me after the hearing approval, and he said, you know, Ned, we at Syncrude are very happy that Sunoil got this, because if you go broke, it's just one company. If we go broke, it's seven companies.
Right. All consortium. And it was how many years before Suncor actually started to make money? I mean,
quite a long time after the plant started.
Yeah, Pugh had died actually by the time they started to make money. So he never saw it make money in his lifetime.
Back to the Bible radio show. How widely was it broadcast?
Right across Canada.
Oh,
everywhere. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I wasn't doing it in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
I thought it was just Alberta.
Oh, no.
No, in fact, when Manning first heard it, the program, he was a teenager working on the farm in Saskatchewan. And he went out and used the money from harvesting to put up, to buy a radio and string up the aerial to the chimney and outside, and then he heard William Eberhardt on the radio and thought, wow, I mean, he was just totally inspired. And so Manning then came to Calgary to meet Eberhardt to become a minister of the gospel. That's what brought him to Alberta in the first instance. I mean, he had no intention of ever going into politics. And it was the Depression then that pushed both of them into politics. The United Farmers didn't have an answer to the Depression. Mind you, nobody did. But the Social Credit came along and said, look, we'll fix the problems. Not only that, but we'll pay everybody $25 a month. Well, why not? I mean, wouldn't you vote for a party like that? and that's essentially what got them into politics. And every time Manning ran in 9 successive elections, never lost an election. And anytime there was the slightest kind of threat to his dominance, he would say, look, if you can find somebody else to do this job, I would just as soon go back to my Bible work. Politics I don't really care about, but I have no choice. If the voters keep re-electing me, you know, I mean, I've got to serve, right? Very effective political strategy. Never lost an election.
They printed their own money at one time.
They did, yeah, the funny money. That's right. Yeah.
Wasn't that
something
to give people the $25?
That's how the first payment eventually was made. And the whole idea there was that this script, as they called it, that would eventually become the official currency of Alberta. Now, mind you, I mean, there was no way that the federal government was going to approve this as the official currency. I mean, the federal government, you know, takes care of Canada's currency system. But that was the plan. But one of the difficulties that they ran into was they said, well, set a good example. The cabinet minister should take a portion of their salary in scrip. And the cabinet minister said, no way. they didn't trust this stuff. You know? We weren't going to have anything to do with funny money. So, but yeah, there was, I think, they have these certificates, these prosperity certificates, as they call them, which I think is quite funny. And then you could buy these stamps, and then when you bought however, you know, say $5 or $10 or $15 worth of stamps, you would turn in the coupon and exchange it for hard currency. But that didn't really work either, because in fact what happened was when people wanted to cash in these certificates, the government basically said, you're going to have to wait because we don't have any money. And those things are still kicking around. As a matter of fact, you can buy them on eBay now. And they're selling for something like $1,200, $1,500. So these little $5, if you held on to it for long enough, you know, you're still around 60 years later, you know. You could make money on eBay at this point.
Brian, I haven't gotten all the way through the book. Do you get into Nathan Tanner and natural gas in the 50s as well?
Yeah, I do. The liberals in those days, I mean, essentially said that they were going to be the guys to block the natural gas exports, and what resulted from that, you know, how they had to have whatever number of years was it, a revolving...
Originally, it was 50.
Yeah, 50 years, yeah. Was it, yeah, of reserves before they could send any gas out of the province. Yeah, so I do. I talk about that, John. Yeah.
Good. Okay, I think this is a break. Sure, Brian.